Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Hey, everybody. It is time for another episode of our Big Blend Radio Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia. But today's show is also part of our Way Back When History Show, our Big Daily Blend Show, and our Women Making History podcast, because this is airing on May 6th, which is National Recognition Day for nurses. And we're going to talk about some medics and nurses in combat. Specifically, we're going to be chatting about Avis D. Shorer. And Avis is featured in Mike's book that is, you can go get it now, Combat Diaries. It is out, so go get it. The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II. But welcome back, Mike. How are you doing?
Hey, Lisa, I'm doing great. And as always, it is great to be on the show. How are you?
Doing good, doing good. I know we want to catch up with some of your news, of course, your books, but the History Channel, we'll get into that in a little bit, that you're going to be on the History Channel once again. Yes. But yeah, I'm excited to talk about, it's Lieutenant Avis Shorer, Daggett Shorer as well. But so she served in World War II, and this is one of your stories from the Combat Diaries. And how did you find out about her?
Well, I came across Avis's story through a mutual friend and historian. His name is Al Zedong. He is local here to the Twin Cities area. He's part of the World War II Roundtable Society, of which I am also a member. And, you know, collectively, Al has spent just an enormous amount of time interviewing and piecing together a lot of firsthand oral histories from veterans throughout the state of Minnesota, really. And one of the veterans that he had the unique privilege to interview was Avis Shorer, and I was thrilled by how he captured that story, because it was told from a lady's perspective. Now, you know, of course, the World War II era Army, what it was at the time, you know, there were, of course, restrictions for women in combat, and there were right up until the previous decade. But to get a firsthand account of someone who was a combat nurse and who saw combat in what was technically a non-combat specialty, yeah, you really just have to take pause and think about how that blurs the lines of, you know, well, how do we differentiate the combat specialties from the non-combat specialties, you know, especially in a world like World War II, when, you know, even your rear area was not completely safe, and even your support staff and your support personnel had to be very close to a forward area and very close to the front lines anyway. And, you know, in order and being able to maintain a degree of collectedness, even in the midst of being so close to all the death and the dying that was happening on the front lines, because, you know, I don't think it's any secret that, you know, if you are a combat medic, or if you are an Army nurse or an Army doctor or some type of medical support personnel, you are going to be the first line of contact for all of the battlefield casualties. You know, you're going to get to see people in, you know, pretty much their worst condition imaginable. You know, they're either, you know, at the higher end, you're going to have, you know, people who are suffering from minor wounds and things that you can easily put a field dressing on and send them back out, to people who are horribly mangled. And to see that on a regular basis, particularly how high and how frequent the casualties were in the European theater, that just has to weigh on your soul. It weighs on your psyche. And I felt like I really wanted to include that in the Combat Diaries, if for no other reason than for the sake of capturing what a lady's perspective was during her service in the war. And I on some subtle level, I think I was also trying to showcase, you know, this is what it means to be a lady in America, 1940s World War II era. Nobody's worried about, you know, becoming a TikTok influencer. Nobody's worried about, you know, becoming the next big viral star to hit it big on whatever social media platform. It's like, you know, this, This girl of pioneer stock, by all accounts, joins the service in the capacity that she can, given all of the laws and regulations at the time, and puts her life on pause to help the war effort. And she does it gracefully and without, a chip on her shoulder to try and prove some point. It's like, this is what it means, I think, in a nutshell, to be an all-American 1940s girl. And I really just wanted to show the work ethic and the service ethic, and the unfiltered patriotism that was very present throughout this entire, through the entire story arc of Avis's life.
And you think back then there wasn't that many women serving in World War II. There were the Rosie the Riveters, right? That
Right.
we've talked about before, and even that predating into a little bit of World War I too. But it gets to Lieutenant Avis. Sure. She was in an evacuation hospital in North Africa in Italy. Now think about being in North Africa, and not really having a bunch of ladies around you, right? We didn't have that many female nurses in World War II overseas. I mean, that's.
I mean, they of course were there. There weren't a lot of them, but they didn't turn down anyone who had proper nurse training, whether they were male or female. And one of the things that Avis commented on that really stuck with me was that the army nurses, they were part of the regular army. They were not segregated into the Women's Army Corps, so they weren't WACs, and of course each of the armed forces had their own separate segregated corps for women. Of course the army had their WACs. In the Navy, it was the WAVES. In the Army Air Forces, it was the WASPs. The Coast Guard had the SPARs, and the Marines, they had their, I mean, they didn't have a cool nickname for it, but they just called it the Women's Reserve. There were segregated units and roles that women would play within the armed forces. But Avis noted that, hey, if you were a nurse, you were regular army. You didn't get any of the WAC designations, and you were just right there in the field evacuation hospital patching up whoever it was who came in all torn up. And that I think was an immense point of pride for her. Not in like a feminist agenda kind of way. It's more like, hey, I'm proud to be part of the regular body of troops who are making who are the spearhead of the war effort in a sense.
And with her, she was also one of the she landed one of the first to land on the Anzio beachhead, her and 25 others. Where is the Anzio beachhead? Because apparently that's what she wrote a book called Hell's Half Acre. And that area was called that, but that's what she wrote a book about. And Hell's Half Acre, what she called it, a half acre of hell, a combat nurse in World War II. But I mean, half acre of hell, that sounds hellish. Like, where was that? Was that
It
North
is.
Africa or Italy?
So Anzio was in Italy. That was part of the Italian campaign. So by mid to late 1943, we had pretty much closed the North African front of the war, and we were getting ready to invade mainland Europe. So the first point of that strategy was to invade the what we thought was going to be the soft underbelly. So we were going to hit Sicily, we were going to hit Italy, and one of the points of entry for us in the Italian campaign was Anzio, where Anzio, of course, goes down in history as one of the bloodiest battles of 1943, and just one where we had a well, I won't say we had an impossible time, but it was just a very tough slogging mission to it was a very tough slogging mission. I'm sorry, I said 1943. I meant 1944. But throughout the Italian campaign, there was this drive towards Rome, a drive to at least eliminate the fascist Italian part of the Axis trifecta, and the beachhead at Anzio was just a rough slog for those who were part of that initial invasion force, and it was rough going for everyone, and to be a part of that initial landing, and Avis went on to describe. To describe in excruciating detail the conditions on the landing ship that brought her there. And when you read through what she had to say, you really find out that the trip to Anzio was almost as bad as the landing, because they had one of these British manufactured landing craft, and those are those aren't really stabilized boats. So, you're sloshing up and down as the current and the tides go up and down as you're going through the sea. And you're not put in fancy staterooms. You're staying in the cargo hold of the ship. Well, your bathroom is nothing more than a bucket that's in the middle of the floor. And if you catch a big
Cool.
wake, everything in that bucket is going, it's probably first going to hit the ceiling, and then it's going to splatter on the floor.
Nice.
And with that, you're that close to the you're that close to the engine bay, so you're constantly having to deal with the mixed aroma of human excrement along with fumes from the ship's engine. And she said, we didn't get any blankets, some of the nurses got
Oh.
sick just at the sight of the ship. And she said, it was horrible, because you were tossed up and down like a cork, and she also wrote that some of the nurses would just throw up into their helmets. I mean, your steel pot helmet had to become its own barf bag, because that was the only thing that you had. And hopefully you could rinse it out enough, to where the time you hit the shores, you were able to put it on your head and not feel any caked up vomit there as you went,
Oh.
as you went to as you went to go meet the enemy. By the time they landed, or by the time they were getting ready to land, only 26 nurses were healthy enough to get from the LCI to the actual landing craft itself. Some of them had just been rendered immobile from the seasickness. To make matters worse, when they make landfall at the beach, they're still under enemy fire. And
Right, because they're getting nailed by the Germans, really, at
that's
this
right.
point, right? Oh my God.
And these nurses, they come off the landing craft at the beach at Anzio, and the nurses, they barely got a few miles inland, where a male officer stopped them and said, "What are you ladies doing here? This place is hot. You got to get out of here." But they're like, "Well, no, we're the nurses. We're the only nurses you guys have. So, please tell us where this evacuation, hospital, or the evacuation medical depot is, so we can get parceled out to where we need." She says that it was just crazy. We were so tired. We had no sleep for days, and we were trying to find where we try we're trying to find where we needed to be while under enemy fire. And
Oh.
it was quite a chore, and trying to get everybody of the 56 consolidated was just a task unto itself, because that evacuation hospital, all of its personnel had been split up among five different landing ships.
Oh.
You'd have the administration section be on one ship, the ops section would be on another, the resupply section would be on another ship, and here we are just trying to make sense out of where everything and everybody is. And it's pretty intense.
I think it's freaky. I mean, that's a scary thing. And to think that you decided to go and do this when, you could be home safer and helping in a safer manner, right? Yeah, I mean, she seems to have a lot of, just integrity for what she was doing and care. And it's also, not only is it scary, right? And gross, as you say, And on top of that, you're dealing with, soldiers that are wounded and dying and death, and you're dealing with people that you're in this, horrific war with, and the other nurses and medics, and you're losing them too, right? And the doctors, they're all kind of together in this boat, literal boat, right? And then there's that too, just that loss. And we've talked about that even on the last podcast about, the carnage part of it. And I just since actually just did an interview with an Iraq war veteran, and she was just she said it, she had to go through a lot of work to get past the carnage part of it. And so back then, I don't think we had the support for those who were in service seeing all of that and witnessing it, because I don't think you can really imagine it. And we didn't even have like TV and movies and the internet and everything to really get us up to speed if out there, So I think she that was probably quite a shock, right?
It was. Yeah, it really
Oh.
was. Yeah. So, and things only got marginally better after they finally consolidated everybody for the evacuation hospital, because when they set up everything, they were very quick to put the Red Cross markings on their tents and equipment, so everyone, enemy included, would know, hey, this is a medical facility. And according to the conventions of war, at least at the time, and this is the way it was throughout most of Western history, you clearly mark your aid stations, you clearly mark your medical personnel, and it's not considered proper to engage them with hostile fire because it's a medical facility. So, despite those prominent Red Cross markings, though, the hospital itself was frequently under attack. And what made matters worse, and I don't even know if the planners who set up the logistical bases were aware of this at first, but they put the field hospital right by the fuel and ammunition dumps. Now, you see a fuel and an ammunition dump from the air. Those are pretty easy to spot and pretty easy to make out with aerial reconnaissance. So you know that those are going to be priority targets for the Luftwaffe and for any German artillery. So you're putting your field hospital right next to those. Even if the Germans are trying to avoid getting the hospital, that hospital is going to be collateral damage when everything else blows up. And I remember, for the constant attacks, she was saying, hey, at night it was lit up brighter than the sunshine by all of the flares and explosions, and it got so bad that some wounded men, when they were brought into the field hospital, they'd asked to go back to their foxholes because it was actually safer there. Yeah.
But you'd think, oh, this is a hospital, it's safe, but
Yeah.
it wasn't. Wow, what a story. I mean, and what a nice lady, So that's a So she does a lot, and she wrote about it, which I think is also really cool that she did that. And gosh, that's amazing. And so she passed away not too long ago, actually, right? She was she's done a lot. Wow. She died in 2016.
That's right.
Yeah, like you were saying, writing the combat diaries was an important thing because so many of our service people for World War II are passing away.
Yeah,
I
as a
don't
matter of
think
fact,
there's. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, I think of all the people featured in the Combat Diaries, Marty Romano, he just recently passed away last year. And I think all of them, there's only one who's still living. I should say that with a I should say that with bated breath, because at least the last I heard, he was still living. So Tom Stafford, I think Tom Stafford in Chapter 15, I think he's the only member of the Combat Diaries who is still alive.
Oh, wow. So that's a good thing you did it.
Yeah.
And those who are alive during the time, I mean, it's just nice that they were honored even while they were living too. You know,
Yeah.
so many times people are, you know, looked at their legacy in their life afterwards, and it's like whatever we can do while people are living, I think is a good thing. You know, let them feel, you know, honored and respected for their, you know, giving. And I mean, in general, when you look at medics and nurses in combat, I mean, aren't they just, you know, it's like when we were talking about the combat engineers, in your book, Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam, everyone out now, and a bestseller, go get it. You know, so that was Vietnam, but you were talking about the combat engineers again, somebody that we forget about. And I think sometimes the medics and nurses get forgotten about in regards to combat. And aren't they just as much danger, like you were saying, even with the way the evacuation hospital was?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, so that's quite a story. I wanted to touch on too. I know we were talking about ladies out there, Avis, but you also wrote about Alfred Rascon, right? Am I pronouncing his na last name Rascon? And
Yes.
he was in, yeah, tell us about that, his story. He
Okay.
was in Fire in the Hole, right? Have I got the right
No.
one? No.
No, he was in Vietnam, but this is actually an independent biography that I've taken up on, and I'm
Oh.
currently working with Alfred Rascon and his family
Oh,
to
wow.
piece this together. So Alfred Rascon, incredible story about this gentleman. So he is still alive, and born in Chihuahua, Mexico, back in September of 1945. And when he was very young, his family immigrated to the US, where they settled in California. That's where he, came up through the primary secondary schools in the California school system. And then in August 1963, he enlisted in the army. Enlists as a combat medic, and the combat medics themselves are really nothing short of your angels on the battlefield. They are kin to what we see in civilian life as paramedics, people who are your first responders and can render the proper treatment to any number of people. And of course, the combat medics, they take it a step further to expand their training and adapt it to a military environment. And he goes through his combat medic training at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, which is in San Antonio, now part of the Joint Base Network in San Antonio, which includes Lackland and Randolph Air Force Base. In May of 1965, he and his unit deployed to Vietnam. So he is there at roughly the same time the 1st Infantry Division is, in their story, Fire in the Hole. And he is assigned as a medic to a recon platoon of the 173rd Airborne Brigade. So he is in a battle. This is in March of 1966, where they are in Long Cang province. And when the recon platoon is called upon to reinforce a sister battalion that is under enemy fire, the platoon itself, of course, comes under fire. And Rascon, who at this time is a specialist, he makes his way forward to rescue many of his fallen comrades. He goes exposing himself to enemy fire and grenades, and he covers the bodies of some of his wounded comrades and absorbs some of the blast of those grenades, taking some shrapnel and shell fragments along with him. And finally he dragged his comrades back to safety. Well, when he when you know the recovery team finally came through and picked up all the wounded, he was of course with them, and he was wounded so badly that the chaplain that was attached to the field hospital gave him his last rites, because he's like, hey, there's no way that this
Wow.
poor kid's going to make it. But miraculously, he survived, and he was nominated, he was put in for the Medal of Honor. But for some reason, we still don't quite know why, His award was downgraded from initially, it was downgraded from a Medal of Honor to a Silver Star. And I mean, not that a Silver Star is trivial by any means, it's not, but his actions definitely warranted the Medal of Honor. So, he didn't think too much of it at the time, but he was just glad to have survived and glad that he could have saved the lives of a few others. So he gets out of the army initially in 1966, and he transfers to the Army Reserve. And he attends college, and in 1967 he actually becomes a U.S. citizen. Well, after while he's completing his degree, he decides he wants to get back onto active duty. So after he finishes college in 1970, he enters the Army's Officer Candidate School, OCS, and he becomes a second lieutenant of infantry. Then he goes back to Vietnam a second time, but this time as a military advisor, trying to make sure that the South Vietnamese armed forces can stand on their own. So he stays on active duty until 1976, and has a discharge, honorably discharged with the rank of captain, but goes back to the Army Reserve, serves until 84. Now, during the interim, he does a lot of work down in Panama with the FBI, the DEA, INS, and is helping to run ops against the drug trade and even keep tabs on Noriega while he was still running the show down in Panama. So he does that all throughout the late 70s into the 80s. He's a point man for the Pentagon and the DEA. And trying to combat the drug trade. He's really the part of the inaugural group of the war on drugs. And then finally, it was at a 1985 reunion where many of Rascone's comrades had discovered that even though he had been nominated for the Medal of Honor, he never got it. And they were just beside themselves. They're like, Alfred, if anybody deserves the Medal of Honor from that campaign, it's you. There's no reason why it should have been downgraded. So a few of his comrades, they petitioned the Pentagon. They even petitioned one of their local congressmen, and that congressman spearheaded the effort. And by 1999, in the year 2000, Bill Clinton had personally given his attention to the matter. And and said, after the investigation, they're like, hey, no, this guy deserves the Medal of Honor. And in February of 2000, this was Clinton's last year in office. February of 2000, Clinton gave Rascone the Medal of Honor in a ceremony in the East Room of the White House, and said, essentially said, hey, better late than never. And then, of course, after 9/11, Rascone decides he wants to, try to affect some positive change now that we're in this war on terror. So first, right after 9/11, well, thereabouts anyway, President Bush appoints Rascone to be the director of the Selective Service System, collecting names for a military registry in case there's a draft again. And then on September 1st, 2002, so this is just barely a year later, Alfred Rascone returns to the Army as a reserve major in the Army Medical Service Corps. And he's the he deploys to Iraq and Afghanistan again, as an individual augmentee, essentially representing the Surgeon General's office, and making sure that our soldiers, in Iraq and Afghanistan are getting the proper treatment. So, it's just
He's done
incredible
well.
to see that, that many years after winning the Medal of Honor, after, serving on the front line in the war on drugs, now he's back again in uniform in the war on terror, and just carrying forward that same service and ethic and same service mentality that he's had all along. And that really just it really just ties into the whole theme that our combat medics Army nurses, Army doctors, and I mean, this goes for the medics across all branches of service, you know, whether it's a medic in the Army or the Air Force, or it's a corpsman, as they call them, you know, a person of the medical corps, a corpsman in the Navy or the Coast Guard. You know, it's these are the folks who help patch up our wounded warriors to make sure that they can essentially get back on the battlefield for another day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. What a
Yeah.
career. I can't wait for the book, man. Get on with it. I'm
Yes,
just kidding.
ma'am.
I'm just kidding. How many books are you at now? Again, I always have to ask because it's always growing.
26, I think.
Wow, Mike, insane. And what is the next one that's going to come out? Because I know you work on a lot all the time.
Let's see. There's that one. There is Viper Alley, which is about the F-16. I know that that's on the way, as well as Sarajevo at Dawn, which is about the spy war in Bosnia.
Wow. Lots going on. Very cool. Very cool. So we've got to talk about the History Channel. You were on that before with a couple. How many episodes were you on? And tell everybody about that show because people, you know, I know that they re-air and you know shows all the time. We do it here too. So tell everyone about the one that you're on and then what's happening now because people can start seeing you on new episodes on the History Channel.
So the first show I appeared on the History Channel was a show called I Was There, and it was hosted by Theo Wilson. And the whole setup of the series, if I can compare it to anything that is probably well known in pop culture, it's a similar setup to Quantum Leap. And I use that analogy because the host of the show, Theo Wilson, you know, he is essentially dropped into the middle of all of these great historical events as they're happening. And he's serving as the narrator. He's looking at the camera while, you know, all the historical action is going on right alongside him. And, you know, he says, you know, okay, well, here we are in, you know, here we are in the Soviet city of such and such, or here we are on the battlefield of this place or wherever, or here we are in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. And he's narrating everything that's happening. And then throughout all of the action that's happening on the screen, you have various parts of each episode that are cut to an expert or historian, someone who's providing a lot of additional commentary, you know, and voiceovers as they further clarify all the action that's happening. So that was the premise of I Was There. And then I was in a few episodes for season one. Still no official word when there's going to be a season two. Looking good though.
Hey,
But
man.
for season one, I was in the episodes on the Johnstown flood, the Chernobyl explosion, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the Battle of Stalingrad. And just an incredible experience working on that show. Loved every minute of it. Had a chance to meet and converse with some outstanding people. And then about a year later, I got another call from A&E Networks, you know, who owns the History Channel, and they said, "Hey, we're starting this series called Military Mysteries." Now, Military Mysteries in its current form, the one that's airing, it premieres April 22nd. Now, Military Mysteries is kind of a spin-off, well, a spin-off to The Proof Is Out There. And the approach, as I can describe it, is, you know how there are multiple iterations of the CSI crime TV show? You had the original CSI that was in Las Vegas, and then they had CSI Miami, CSI New York. Well, they're kind of doing the same thing with Proof Is Out There, because the original Proof Is Out There, what is a series that involves, you know, like aliens and the paranormal and a lot of, you know, just natural phenomenon that's out there. Whereas The Proof Is Out There, Military Mysteries is, you know, now the affiliate, or I guess the spinoff series of that, to where it's focusing on mysteries and unexplained phenomenon within the context of military operations. So
Cool.
for this first season, there are going to be 6 episodes. This show, to my knowledge, has been greenlit for at least 4 seasons.
Oh,
So
wow.
knock on wood, all 4 seasons will come to fruition, and hopefully there will be even more of them.
And
So
that's cool.
yeah, so of these 6 premiere episodes, I know for sure, just based on what the thematic elements are, I know for sure that I'm going to be in at least 2 of them, possibly 4. It just depends on how they take all the segments and put them into episodes, because every episode will deal with multiple topics. I know for sure that the episodes that I am going to be featured in, one involves the case of a U.S. Air Force officer by the name of Major Logan, who was a downed aviator over Korea, held as a prisoner of war, but his ultimate fate remains unknown. We can confirm that he was a POW at some point because of the photographic evidence we have, but still, there's a lot of contradictory evidence and intrigue to try to determine what ultimately happened to him. And then there's going to be another episode that involves the weaponized use of dolphins that the U.S. Navy was trying to
Oh,
accomplish.
yeah. I remember
Yeah.
stuff up. I'm, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there's another interesting segment that involves a potential Trojan horse into the Gulf War that the British government did, co-opted unwittingly or not by of all people, British Airways. So the setup for this is British Airways Flight 149. And Flight 149 was a flight that was going from London Heathrow to Singapore, I believe, was the final destination, but they had a layover in Kuwait. Well, the plane takes flight August 2nd of 1990, which was when Iraq invaded Kuwait, and many other commercial jetliners were vectored away from Kuwait City International Airport, except for Flight 149. 149 landed on the tarmac there at the airport, and what's interesting is that, every other flight was diverted except for this one. But then when the plane landed, there were 4 gentlemen on the plane who stood up and left the plane very quickly. They were the first passengers to disembark. And the only thing is that these 4 bodies represent 4 extra persons who were not on the passenger manifest. So these gentlemen, and almost everybody on the flight remembers seeing them. They corroborate, hey, these 4 gentlemen were there. They weren't really talking to anybody. They were all very tall. They had athletic builds. They had close cropped hair. So the ongoing theory is that these gentlemen were very likely British SAS agents who were, put on the ground to run ops and collect intelligence for the British government as the Gulf War was kicking off, because nobody can account for who these guys were, why they were there, why there were 4 extra people on the plane than what the passenger manifest list said, and why just those 4 left, but everybody stayed on the plane. And the ongoing theory is, okay, well, these guys were the Trojan horse from the British government to get in to Kuwait to, get some actionable intelligence on what exactly was happening. Now, of course, the British government has denied this. British Airways has denied this. And if it is true, I don't necessarily fault them for denying it, because is this really the thing that you want to admit you did? And the downstream effects of this were that the other passengers on that British Airways flight, the flight itself and the plane, were detained and impounded, and every other passenger on the plane was detained as a guest. A quote unquote guest of the Iraqi government. Well, eventually some of them were used as human shields, to try to dissuade the Allied, forces from bombing both Iraq and Kuwait. And on some level, you have to think to yourself, now, it doesn't necessarily surprise me that the British government would deny doing it, The thing is that if it was a matter of them trying to put a Trojan horse in there, they were probably thinking to themselves, and of course this is naive, but on the surface it appears logical, is they would say, okay, suppose we do put this Trojan horse in there and we infiltrate some SAS agents into, Kuwait. It's British Airways, and we are the United Kingdom. Saddam doesn't have any beef with us. His beef is with Kuwait. His beef is with Iran. I mean, if anything, Iran, or excuse me, Iraq has been our ally for many, many years now. Saddam has no beef with us. Probably what's going to happen, if anything does happen, is they will probably detain the plane long enough to realize, oh, it's a British Airways flight with a bunch of civilians. Get them out of here. Them go on to their final destination because, after all, we're the Brits. What problem would Saddam Hussein have with us?
Oh, man.
And again, logical on the surface, but very, I'll say, naively optimistic, because remember who we're dealing with here. I mean, the guy who started a war with Iran for no good reason and arbitrarily decided he wants to invade his neighbor to the south. Are you really going to rely on the improbable good graces of a dictatorial madman? And yeah, he
You
may be,
can't.
yeah. I mean, he may be on good terms with the UK. He was even on good terms with the US at that time, but we considered him an ally in the very vaguest sense of the term, as in he's not our enemy, but God, this guy's nuts.
Yeah, but he had like a he was like a, Mr. Personality before everything went nuts. Like he got people to really like him. He was almost like a TV personality, and in a way, right? Wasn't he kind of like that, trying to get him? I mean, I wonder if he was scheming that the whole time, like he set himself up to be liked, and then it's weird, I don't know how far he went, but dictators do that, don't they? They reel you in, just like it's the same thing as a cult leader. Uh-oh, I'm back in cult land. I can't help it. I'm fascinated by it. But these mysteries, I mean, it's interesting because I mean, does the government want people to know about all this stuff and dig around to try and solve it? Or is this like stuff that just gets unclassified and has been under wraps for a while, these stories? I
Well,
mean,
a lot
are
of
you
it.
going to get in trouble on the History Channel?
Oh no, no. Everything that we know about British Airways Flight 149 has at least been declassified to a point. There are just a lot of things that don't add up. Two and two keep adding up to five, and of course, the official line has been, no, the British government did not officially endorse this. British Airways was not a willing accomplice, and this, that, or the other. And the places where there would normally be verifiable records, those verifiable records have been mysteriously misplaced and are missing from the
It's
are
like
missing
D.B.
from
Cooper. The D.B. Cooper story.
right.
That still gets me. Man, good stuff. Mike, it's exciting. It's
It
exciting,
is.
hearing all these stories and also I think it gets people to understand things happen out there, and they may not always be explained. I love it. I love it. Well, thank you again. Always fun having you on the show. We look forward to next month. So everyone, Mike is here every first Monday. So stay tuned at bigblendradio.com for that. But also keep up with Mike at mikeguardia.com. I encourage you, if you are into military history, to look him up on YouTube. He does a lot on YouTube and Facebook, and he's also on Twitter. So and Instagram. He finally got on Instagram. So he's everywhere. So keep up with him there. But take care, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show, featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at mikeguardia.com. Follow us at bigblendradio.com.